We've been talking about, or we started talking about, the five houses of Zen, see? And these are simply, they sometimes refer to them as the five schools. And we looked at, we took an overview from Tom Cleary on this last time. And what we realized is that the person, well, let me see if I still have his quote here. He said, we should remember that although these grand masters of the five houses were eminent teachers, and the theoretical concept of the houses seems to center around their teachings, in fact, virtually nothing is known of the inner or outer lives of these individuals, and no organizations can actually be traced to them. See, and yet, this is what scholars do. See, they put together, they fabricate a history. See, and then we begin to, and that's actually what you do inside your head if you see it. See, you come up with notions about how you think people are feeling about you. But when I did this, you understand that you will never know what I experienced. And that's true of everything else. You only know what you think others are thinking. Then the terrible part of that is you react to your own projections. You project, then you react to them. And we're in the world of suffering, see? And if you can just become clear, mirror-like, see? This is the status of mind, mirror-like. Then you sustain this. And lo and behold, you'll experience your life in a different way. Absolutely 100% true. See, and it can transform you. The deeper you go into that, the more amazing it becomes. But anyway, back to these guys. I get carried away. See, he said, in short, these original houses were not institutionalized, their teachings were not dogmatized, and their guides and exemplars were not idolized. See, and that's an amazing thing about these old Chan masters, because we have a misconception, see, that these were semi-deities. See, even the Shakyamuni Buddha, see, is no god. See, Shakyamuni was a man, see, who was born into great wealth, great comfort, see. His father was a king, and he was a prince, see, of the Shaka clan. See, and if you want to take the Buddha's story, see, as a parable, see, that was comparable to your lives, see, to be born into this wealthy setting means you're young. See, and in the youth, in this place of our youth, we have all these fantasies. We know that the next big party is going to be it. See, we know that I can grease my brain with ecstasy. And wow, what I experience. Hammer myself with all sorts of high decibel rating music, see, pound myself, and it's going to be great. Except it's burnt out the next day. The moment the party starts, the party is in the process of ending. See, that's this world here of samsara. The moment you're born, when you look at that cute baby and go, goo, 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 that baby is on the path to destruction. The one thing that you can guarantee for that baby is that it will die. See, that's the winning hand. See, so Buddha, when he jumped over the palace wall because he got tired of, you know, all of the parties. Hey, his dad kept the most beautiful, the youngest ladies around him. They had the best food, the best incense, I guess. That's a concession to the musician. See? But at some place there's a stirring occurs within us. See? And sometimes that's why people are here. Sometimes people are just drug here because somebody has this little itch that they want to test and see what it is, see? But something starts to turn in us. See? And this is what happened with Buddha. See, he jumped over the wall. And when he went out, what did he see? The thing that I just talked about. He saw old age. He saw sickness. And he saw death. And then he asked, see, his attendant, who was older and was wise to the ways of the world. See, as you jump over the fence of youth, see, and begin to see the folly of my fantasies of what it's going to be like next week, next year. To begin as I age, I begin to realize those fantasies aren't coming true. And then I also have had the terrible experience of when the fantasies do come true, they're not long-lived. I get it, and I'm already disappointed with it. And here, some of them hear the same story. We have a monk sits in here who wanted this super deluxe car. He got this top-of-the-line Lexus. And it's real. This is a true story. He's sitting in here right with you guys right now. See, and I always embarrass him with it. But he told me the story. He said, you know, Nyogen, he said, when I drove it off the lot, he wanted this car. And he said, as I drove it off the lot, started driving it home, I knew I didn't like it. Now, figure that. See, but that's that sense of the impermanence and realizing that it's a myth. Samsara does not bring about the kind of change that is so important. See, so at some point, when you're tired of being hammered in the parties, and you look in the mirror in the morning, and oh my goodness, the lines, where do those come from? See, you got options, Botox, facelift, see, but I'm too young for that, see. But what is this? What does this mean to me? Then you go to somebody and you go to your mom or friend and say, Mom, am I getting old? And well, yes, dear. Well, do I have to get old like you? Well, yes, dear, that's the way it is. And this is what the companion told Buddha. See, this is how it is. This is how it is. And we will struggle with that. When I'm in the palace, I try not to see that. So I just turn over. I have a cutoff part. Age. For any of the girls over 21, out the door. See, they move up into the dad's section of the palace, see. But not down here with the young prince. See, same thing with the people who wait on him. They all got to be young and beautiful. See. There are no droughts. There are no famines there. But he keeps moving along. See, and at some point, you test the boundaries. Some people don't. You have friends like that who will never grow up, or they become hopelessly lost in trying to somehow or another, see, put salve on the pain of living, because that's how it is. That's what Buddha... At that point, you jump over the wall, you leave the ivory tower, and you start to deal with the reality. And for some people, it's around 30, 31, 32, you'll have your first depression. The first sense of, oh my God, we have someone, she's not up here now, she might be listening, but we went through that with her as she approached 30. Are you listening? See? She was starting to go into a despair. And she was doing all of the good things in the world of samsara. She was completing her PhD in genetics, see? But 30 still rushed at her, see? Then she went on, because she's one of these compulsive go-to-school types. See, she's accomplishing things, and she went for her MBA. I pointed out that she was rushing toward 35, see? Now she's moved on a little in being very delicate about these issues. I won't say how much she's rushed past 35. But she did tell me the other day that 40 is the new 20. See? See? But all of a sudden it doesn't work. You cannot stop it. And that's what Buddha saw. And then when Buddha looked out, what he saw was the best you can hope for. The best is old age. See? Sickness and death. That's a winning hand in samsara. And Buddha, being a smart guy, said, what the hell is this? That's, how can anybody be comfortable there? How can you be comfortable unless you live a totally delusional life? And some people try to resolve that by being drug addicts, alcoholics, see, or some just go insane. But there's a way out, and that's what Buddha, see, taught. See, there's something else quite amazing. See, so in these five houses we're talking about, these are very famous, see, in the great classical sense. Last week we started talking about the great Isan, or Kweishan, see, Isan, one of my favorites. And for the women, and I always point this out to the women, see, Buddha Dharma and these great Zen masters, see, this is where women find absolute equality. And if you've ever heard anything or read anything in the Buddhist, where they'll talk about you have to be reincarnated as a man before you can reach enlightenment, whoever wrote that down, and I don't care what the name attached to it, they're in delusion and they have no idea what it is. Our altar, see, you're on the left-hand side. That's the Kuan Yin, but that's the female form of Avalokiteshvara. That is great compassion, see, and the kind of compassion and care that's fearless. It will go down into hell. This is a mother. We'll go down in hell to suffer those who are in pain. See? And she weeps forever for those trapped in samsara and their pain and suffering. By the way we have her manifest there, for Kyoji, see, she will go down and she'll save the animals. And I'm hoping that she'll even save stupid old Zen teachers. See? Because I need a lot of help in that realm, see? But what I found interesting, today we're going to look at the great Lin Chi, Rinzai, see? And one of the most dynamic lines, and you understand that this is one of the lines that is still in existence today. And this line came into existence around the 800s. And it's still a vibrant, dynamic line. In this practice here, I am a Soto priest. The people wearing robes are Soto priests, which is the Soto aspect. One of the five families that's still alive. Soto, but I was trained Rinzai style. See, and if you different times, I'll talk on koans. See, in Rinzai, they're famous for working with the koans. The sound of one hand clapping. Muji, show me your face before your parents were born. These are koans. And some of them go into quite elaborate, quite beautiful. And the practice itself, see, is to help you walk out of the labyrinth of your egocentric mind. Those who can do it, not everybody can do koan practice. Some people are ideally suited for it, others aren't. In the Soto aspect, we do what we call shikantaza. These people are called the wall gazers. And that's you simply sit with no thinking. And my teacher, who was a genius, who had transmission through three lines, see, it's almost unheard of, what he would say of shikantaza, see, is it is the most difficult koan of all. And he had practiced for 45 years sitting. When he told me with a little smile on his face, he said, I think I'm starting to sit shikantaza. And he'd been sitting 45 years. But don't despair. What he considered shikantaza and what we consider shikantaza is the difference between walking, you know, at sea level or walking at the peak of Mount Everest, see. Lots of difference. I would just love to have been able to look through that side of his eyeballs, see. So we're going to be looking at the great Rinzai. And I want to do the same thing that we did last week with Isan, where we took his great teacher, Pai Chang, and looked at Pai Chang's teaching. Then Thursday night, I brought Isan's teaching in, and we brought in a koan at this time, and I'll probably still try to do some of that. But it's, you know, with Rinzai, he had one of the greatest teachers that I have focused on some because I was particularly attracted to his teaching, the great Wangbo, or Obaku in the Japanese style, see. And I want to draw the comparisons and see if the thread of the teaching, if we can see it from one house to the next. At one point, I think it was Mei Zen who had an idea of doing something from the great song through the current period down through my teacher to see if we could find a common thread, if the teaching had remained constant and was it very clearly, see, expressed with the masters that we had access to down. And of course it is. And in some sense, we're always talking just about the same thing. And in the five houses with these great personalities, that's the only difference. I'll tell you, take away the punchline. See, it's very clear what they teach. It's very simple. It's very direct. However, they bring their own unique style. And that was the genius of my teacher. See, my teacher's genius was that he did not try to influence, see, the personalities of his successors. Can't do that. See, can't. If you do that, then you're trying to develop clones and it will not be living practice. See, living practice. And that kind of a person should never teach, because they're not teaching. See, there is nothing to teach in Buddha Dharma. But see, they will try to teach you to measure to whatever their level, their expectation, their standards. But a real Zen master, see, tries to encourage, to help you, see, to open the treasury door, see, to what you truly are. That's their genius. See, and that genius was appreciated. So here with the great Rinzai, and we could almost say that they're teachers, Wang Bo for the great Rinzai, and we could say Pai Cheng, Yakujo. See, and there's a connection here. The Japanese is Yakujo, see, and Isan. And you could almost say that the teachers of these great personalities were the founders of the house. But now, interestingly enough, Rinzai's teacher, see, Obaku, see, studied and was a successor to Yakujo. Isan studied and was a successor to Yakujo. See, so we could in some sense say both of these old masters walk on the same path, but they express it in a different way. Wang Bo said that Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. There is no other reality. This mind, from beginninglessness, has never been born and never passes away. That should intrigue you, because I said that the only fate that you had in store for you, the most promising, brightest future you have, is old age, sickness, and death. See? That should depress you a little. See, no matter what you do, with the one person I just talked about, I don't know if she'll go on to collect more and more degrees, trying to hold back 40, but it's just like an avalanche. Just sweeps down and carries you away, see? But what is he saying here? See, this Buddha mind, from beginninglessness, has never been born and never passed away. Did we hear something similar to that? See, with the great Yakujo and Isan, when we actually, I concluded Thursday night with several paragraphs of Isan's teaching. It's a mirror image. He said, this Buddha mind, it does not belong to existence or non-existence. It does not count as new or old. It is like space, which has no boundaries and cannot be measured. My God, what is he talking about? What is this most amazing thing? Get quiet. Don't think. Don't think. Simply sit here. See? This is this Buddha mind. Don't try to understand. Just be here. The helicopter, the feeling in your legs, your butt. See? If the mind is churning, don't follow the thoughts. You don't try to suppress them either. Just see. But what is sitting here? See, you're sitting here even as thoughts turn. See, that's sitting here. See, this is the Buddha mind. Buddha, awake. This is the awake mind. This is the eternal now. This now, this moment of now. You will never find a moment in your life when you leave here, you'll think about it, when it isn't now. See, you will always be here now. This now, the old Zen masters call it the 10,000-year-long second. That means it's eternal. See? And what you see here, this is the dance of illusion. And how you think about this, you project out. We produce our own heaven and hell. The now is eternal. And its boundaries cannot, see, it's as vast, as vast, as vast. And you begin in Zazen to experience the reality of this. See? But if you go back and think, you let those thoughts start, see, it'll pull you away. See, that's the difficult part. See, we call it samadhi. Samadhi simply means, it's a Sanskrit term, samadhi simply means non-distracted awareness. Awareness, be aware. You hear the car, you're aware. You feel your butt? You're aware. You hear my voice? You're aware. Don't think about it, but don't leave this open state. This state of awareness. Non-distracted means you're not thinking about it. The moment you go into your head thinking about it, you've lost it. You're in delusion. You're behind your eyelids. See, talking to yourself. You don't see this. You won't even see it. And it's right in front of you. That's the amazing thing. It's hidden in plain sight. He said, this one mind itself, Buddha, this one mind that we just, here, don't fixate on the material. Here, see, it's this state of awareness. Here, this is Buddha. This is the awakened state. You have to live in this state, see, and that's the whole point to the practice of Buddha Dharma. See, that's what it means. A Buddha is one who never leaves samadhi. You never leave the eternal. See? And in that state, you frolic and play. Can be done, but it takes the discipline, the right effort. This one mind is itself Buddha. Buddha and sentient beings are no different. See, don't think a Buddha is an Asian god. It's not. You are this state of awareness, and your karma produces you as you are where you are. And in that you have direction and duration. You can be female, you can work at this, you can go to school, see, you can be so tall, so wide. Duration, you have a length of time, see, that you're going to be healthy and eventually old, sick, and dying, if you're lucky. See, now, in this now, if you're here now, this is where you have power. Anything in your head, see, where you think about it this way or that, means nothing. See, that's playing in a fantasy world. Here now, how I respond to the next moment. If I respond in delusion, see, the picking and choosing mind, that's ego. And that's that dualistic state of separation. But if I'm awake, I'm not separate. See, they call it mirror samadhi. See, I simply look out here and I take care of what needs to be done. See, I don't judge it. I take care of it. If something's down and hurt, I try to get it up. I try to help it. If it needs to be bandaged, I bandage it. If it needs to be smacked on the head, I smack it on the head. If I'm not caught up here pushing a personal agenda, I can discriminate with absolute precision. This can be done. See, people don't believe it because they choose to indulge in their addictions. And the addiction to self is the worst addiction of all. He said, Buddha and sentient beings are no different. It's just that sentient beings seek externally, grasping experiences, losing the more they seek. See, it's to turn the light inward, to take the backward step. See, I keep thinking something out there. Something out there is going to make it good for me. See, dualistic religions, see, trap you in that kind of, it's in the big come and get it day. No, the big come get it day never arrives. See, never arrives. It's always out there someplace. See? And you are still caught in the small, narrow, greedy little mind. See? Small, narrow, greedy little mind. And you know what? It's also terribly frightened. See? And we can swagger and pretend. But see, in the night, when nobody's looking at us, is where we can feel the terror. He says, what you don't realize is that if you can stop thoughts and forget ruminations, the Buddha spontaneously appears. See, and some of you are beginning to see this. See, so simple. Don't think. Mirror-like. See, mirror-like. Just reflect. Just see this. It's reflected here. Now, if you hold that, see this Buddha mind, this Buddha, it manifests. See, and in this room, some of you are seeing it at different levels. Some are right there with it. The problem, see, is that you have to sustain it. You can't cross your fingers. See, we're coming in next week. We start our Rohatsu, commemorating Buddha's enlightenment. See, those of you who are coming for this, this is a wonderful opportunity. See, commit yourself for those days to not leave the state of samadhi. Don't be concerned with comfort or discomfort. See, that's where some of you hold yourself back. Oh, I can't do that. I find that uncomfortable. I don't like being crowded, sleeping where other people are. Whatever you hold on to in this secondary realm, and the secondary realm, if this is the realm of dualistic thinking, whatever you hold on to will keep you, see, from the real experience of Buddha, of awakened state. What you don't realize is that if you stop thoughts and forget ruminations, the Buddha spontaneously appears. Remember, that's what I said. We sit not to produce Buddha mind, not to produce the enlightened state. It's here. You sit because you're a neurotic. See? And he points out, see, we can talk, some of the people here, we can talk about the six perfections. See, and we can perform the myriad practices of purification. See? But what you don't realize is all of the virtues of a perfected Buddha, see, do not need to be added to by cultivation. It automatically takes place. A lot of people feel. And I can remember that I had a lot of this, these feelings that, and I know here, in working with some of you, you have some similar feelings, of being unworthy, feeling like I need some form of purification because I am such an unholy thing. How could I be a Buddha? Well, that's real delusional thinking. But if we are deeply trapped with that, see, the beauty of Zazen is that the purification takes place. You sit down on a cushion and you begin to count your breath. 1 through 10, 1 through 10, over and over and over, and this is a purification process. In the great Dzogchen traditions, they call them nundros. They'll give you some patterns to go over. 100,000 full prostrations, chanting the name of the Buddha. It's purification. You sit and you do it until you get sick of your ruminating mind. And it stops at some point. See? And it starts to stop. And you begin to discipline yourself. See? And usually you make a big show of being spiritual. You know, I got me a guru. I got me a place to practice. And you show up and you really start doing it over and over and over. And pretty soon you get tired, tired, tired. See? And you just think, what the hell, it's not working, see? But it's a habit, and you've made such a big show of your big spiritual practice that you're embarrassed not to keep showing up. See, that's part of the purification process. And at that point, then we turn it a little bit more, see? And you begin, see, to cultivate at a deeper level. In the Nundros, this is really true. They give you, they gave a friend of mine, I think it was 100,000 bows, or it could have been even more than that. But, and this was a woman, see, and it was a great Dzogchen master who gave her this. Wonderful, see? But I saw what it was. It was similar to what we do. She thought it was so great. You should have seen her. She almost floated because we were a small group of us in the room. And she had to leave. I think she was going to be the cook. And he turned to her and he talked to her. And he gave her a practice. And you watched the head. I just got, oh my God. See, huge. See, and he gives you a practice. Nundos, oh yes, master, in a full prostration publicly. It was wonderful. See, oh, crash, total commitment to this great teacher. She floated out the door, see, and called her family and let everybody know, see, about this amazing thing. And you know, it was a psychic connection, you know. It was a very spiritual connection, see, it's just because he picked me out of all the groups that gives it to him. Actually, it was just a marvelous lesson for everybody. So, I mean, she really made it, you know, an obvious thing. Every morning we had to hear her go, oh, 1, crash, oh, 2, crash, see? And the funny part about it is, see, you get out to 2,000, 10,000, see? And pretty soon you hurt. Your body hurts, see? Your hands hurt. And you're embarrassed, because he's gone, see? He just abandoned me here to do this stuff. See? Crash. Now, you'd like to stop there because everything hurts. When you sit on a cushion, you come to your first session, you ask the folks in here, you hurt. See, you hurt. See? But you're too damned embarrassed to quit. See, your ego is that big, you just won't quit. Because what will people think? There are some people that just quit anyway. There are people who get nundras who quit. But in her particular instance, what you could watch, see, is that she was too embarrassed. And by then, she didn't even want to talk about it anymore. Because she felt like she was the biggest fool. See, and she made this big show of committing herself. See? But then when she got up about 50,000, see, physically she was in much better shape. And it didn't even take a big deal. She didn't shout and scream. And the crashing that you used to hear was the weakness in the thighs. See, but she was trimmed out. See, got that stuff done, moving on. See, and now she has just dropped all of her attachments to the teacher. He wasn't going to show up. And she'd gone through all of the cursing him and everything. So you got to curse him. Oh, we had no connect. That's right. See, she hit 75,000. See, and she can see light at the end of the tunnel. Now she does it simply as routine. See, I'm going to get through this. I committed to something. I'm no longer having fantasies about my relationship to the teacher. I'm no longer thinking I'm going to float out my left ear with wings. See? Going to be hooked to a golden little thread. See? All of that's gone. See? And she concludes 100,000. And she thinks she might as well just go along with it because something else took place. She began to experience her life in a different way because she had been beaten down by the nundras. See? And she no longer projected her imagination out here. She just started to work with things as they are because that last 25,000 bows, that's all she did. She came in with no expectation. She bowed, hit the ground, got up on the bead, one, crash, came up, two, crash, came three. And lo and behold, something starts to happen in her life. See, her life is like this. And she liked it. It was changing her. And you know the beauty of it is? At that point, after 100,000 bows, she was ready for the practice. And that's the way it really works. See, inwardly, he said, one of the things that we really need to know also about this, and this was part of what I was talking about here with the nundras. See, you have to lose this feeling of being special. I want to be something extraordinary. See, this is the neurotic place that we live in. This is the extraordinary state. And again, as I say, it's called neurosis, and some of us a psychosis. This is really extraordinary. See, it's ego-driven. Its basic ground is fear, anger. See, but like with her work, see, you've got to get to the place where you're ordinary. And what does ordinary mean? It means where you are as you are. Remember, the entire teaching of Buddha Dharma is you. And so long as you keep looking out here for it, you won't find it. And as long as you are sickened by yourself, and I hope that's it, it's easy to work with people who have a poor self-image. Big inflated self-images are really tough. I've never seen my teacher work successfully with it. I don't know whether it can be. Maybe these people with this exaggerated self of their own, that sense of their own self-importance, maybe you've been born into hell. I hadn't thought about that, but that may be the hell realm. See, and where you want to be is if, like myself, I had a terrible self-image. See, I did not like myself. And that seemed to be relatively easy for my teacher to work with. See, but to become ordinary, and you could see that in the note, you become ordinary. In the way we work here, you start out with becoming inflated. We watch that here. It's an amazing thing this summer.